Dr. Koontz, why do people have such low energy today?
Maybe it's congenital, but there are lots of other factors that could be anything other than congenital. It could be their horrible diet, keeping them sort of sleepy and sluggish all the time. It could be a lack of sunlight, a lack of sleep. Three things I've just mentioned could be added to others, but are probably the primary ones. And a lack of energy also creates a lack of initiative, a lack of a sense of freedom or options in life, which is not about, you know, sort of a stereotypical movie image of what it means to be American, but is about your sense that your life is developing or going somewhere.
So you brought up a couple of episodes ago that it also has something to do with imagination. Now, I don't think anything you said is invalidated, but you gave what would be, I think, you know, kind of the empirical answer.
Yeah.
And somewhere deep inside is this idea of imagination. So do you want to go in that direction from what you just said?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that when you're not getting enough sleep, when you're, you know, just putting into your body whatever someone thought you should be consuming, latest energy drink, ironically, whatever, what you're really doing is you are defining yourself in life as a consumer rather than a producer. And by that, I don't mean that everyone is, you know, hustling and is going to have their own sneaker brand someday, but that your life is actually defined by doing things and achieving things, even within a small sphere of activity. And so I think the lack of imagination is actually induced by the stuff that people do spend time doing, because it is always strange to me when people who have modern appliances say, I don't have time to read a book, or I don't have time to do this, or I don't have time to do that. You have essentially the labor supporting your daily life that only somebody with like 10 plus slaves would have in the 19th century. So what exactly do you not have time for? You know, what are you, splitting wood? You know, are you starting the fire every morning?
Well, what are you doing? There's so many things to consume. And I thought growing up in the 80s, I would be able to consume all of them. And I'm finding that's difficult and it's stressing me out. It's not so good for the system on a number of levels. But deteriorating imagination is something I don't think anyone's really looking at, particularly then when we look at things like education, public education particularly, and the view of learning as kind of a rote or a thing I should spite because it's not real world.
Yeah.
And I think this ties nicely into what a person might feel about life when they're willing to just sit in a homeless camp the rest of it. You know, imagination might be kind of what they're just done with. It's just this, I'm good enough. I don't need to think forward. I don't want a different world. I can't see a different world. I'm homeless.
Yeah. I mean, it could be. I think that I read, it's easier for me to read a lot of people's daily existence who have a house, who have a permanent address, as lacking an imagination. It's just as easy for me to do that with the housed as it is with the homeless at this point, because I think, because the thing that I notice is that people's imaginations are full of the stories, really about everything, that other people tell them. So it's not like they don't have a faculty of imagination. It's that they don't know how to use it in the same sense that they don't know how to change the oil on their car, or they don't know how to start a fire, or any other sort of set of skills they could have for themselves.
Right. One of the strangest phenomena of observing myself post stopping watching movies for a time, experimentally still, but it's just, we're going on a while now. The longer I go into it, the weirder it gets when I'm in a conversation with my family or someone else and I quote a movie. I suddenly am like, wait, why is that the wisdom I decided to share right now? Like, where did that come from? Who ordained this, you know, giving of knowledge now that I would need to chime in with this random thing from some entertainment in my past, some nostalgia, as you pointed out. And so for my own part, you know, if you want to quote movies and you think it's funny, it's great. I mean, I'll sit there with you and we can laugh about Three Amigos till the cows come home and all that. But the idea that my imagination is limited when I'm quoting a movie.
Right.
I'm being quite unimaginative at that moment. I haven't really thought through what everyone else is talking about, and I could engage in a much more real way, unless we're all nostalgic about the movie. Okay, fine. But I'd like to do that more than that in my conversation with my kids, I think.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, and I think the lack of imagination to me is in some ways the most depressing thing, because I could say, change your diet or go outside more or whatever kind of positive basic changes that would just feel better about being alive. The lack of imagination is very, very sad, because it captures not just the body, but the soul. And not that none of these other things has an effect on your soul. You're not dreaming probably as much as you could if you slept enough. But the soul is imprinted upon by media in a way which should carry a very high moral responsibility, because if you're going to take someone's thoughts captive, at least for the time that you're talking or they're watching the movie that you produced, you should do good by them and give them something worthwhile. And also a quality that I find missing in a lot of media, and that's just why I don't consume a whole lot. And then people feel bad, like they're talking to an Amish person when they're talking to me. But I'm kind of okay with
This
that.
is it.
That's my role in life, is to
Own the
be
monk. Own
Amish.
the monk. I'm just a weird monk. I'm just going to do it sideways. It's
Right.
okay. You can be you.
But is that people lose, they lose the capacity for being suggestive. Everything has to be obvious, and it makes life far less interesting. And it also makes you unable to express yourself as well as you could, because most of the power of language, which is what you use with other human beings, most of the power of language is in connotation, not denotation or definition. I think the power that language has, and the power that really good fiction, for instance, I mean, my favorite writer since 15, 20 years ago is William Faulkner. And the power that Faulkner has is not, you always know what Faulkner's talking about. And he basically just wrote about his home county, of all places, not in addition to a few other things. But the reason that he's such a powerful writer is because of his powers of suggestion. He makes you feel what it feels like. But because you have to use your mind to imagine that as you read, it engages you in a totally different way than a more passive form of entertainment.
Well, to read is to imagine, I think, and then to watch TV or to observe a media is not.
Right.
You are being informed instead, or even
Right.
programmed,
Right.
and so there's something there just in the reading itself. I just had to throw the jibe in there that currently my favorite fiction is the U.S. Constitution, but I've come to the conclusion. This is I've been struggling with the like why futility, why vanity, and is fiction a lie? Yes, it is. So how can I read stories, write stories? It's really about me wanting to write stories, and coming to terms with the fact that all history is in fact fiction. I mean, they're trying to have it be true, and we're getting as close as we can. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of spin in most of those documents, really the
Sure.
ones that they taught in my grade school. And so, once you put my novel about, Athanasius' audacity and the weight of lunacy, once you put that out there next to these histories and ask, which one's the lie,
Yeah.
your idea that connotation for truth might be far more useful in our time than, say, denotation of
Yeah.
fact. I think there's something in that. And so when I talk about, say, even the Constitution is fiction, I'm not entirely joking. That really, I think if you're a Christian, everything outside the scriptures should really be considered a form of symbolic fiction in some way. Someone's trying to share an idea with you, to mediate an idea with you, and its capacity, its strength is not going to be its factualness in the present. It's going to be what greater meaning is true beyond it, has led to it, and will lead you from it. And so, yeah, I don't know. That's me trying to redeem fiction writing in my own head, and real, sharing it with you as I talk
Sure.
about it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think fiction, because of its powers of connotation, and because usually history just isn't all that well written, because academics specialize in being horrendous writers. History is different from fiction, not in style or in subject matter, but in its reference. So fiction has no reference outside its own world. History supposedly has reference outside its own world. That's really the difference. It's not like the fiction writer's saying, "Hey, I'm not telling you about real things." He's just saying, "I'm not necessarily telling you about something you could go look up in 1957."
At a certain level, though, it is like there's two things I want to say there. At a certain level, it's like I just don't want you to quibble with me about silly things, so I can tell you the real issue right now. And so I'm going to go into make believe land, and I'm only going to change three people in history, and it's just the rest is normal, so that you know and. And then the other side of it is how much of ancient history, speeches and whatnot, are delivered as they probably should have been delivered maybe as often as they are verbatim what was said and so forth.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, without bothering to get into the scripture issue, I'm an inerrancy inspired guy on that one. I'm just talking general history. I don't see where I have to give even Herodotus, thank you. I don't need to give him more truth-telling, you know, publicly validatable factual value than my poetry that I wrote in high school, in the sense that it's all our hot air trying to handle the present survival situation, one way or the other. And what you want to get into today is whatever hot air I spoke, what I do. What happened? What was the result of all of this opining I've done, this preaching, this prophesying, this academic priestly law abiding that we do so no one can read our documents, whatever guild you're in?
Yeah, and the primacy of deeds over words is not only something that's there in the Sermon on the Mount. It's also something that is not there very often when people evaluate the stories that they're told and they look at what is said, and that carries them away. That's the power that language has, rather than what is done, which is why last week and this week we've been talking about homelessness, because even though it's hard to get metrics on homelessness of all kinds, who's there, how many are there, where are they, where were they before, do they migrate from place to place over the course of the year? Although those are all hard, and so it's hard to make it completely subject to social science the way social scientists want life to be, nonetheless, it is a good metric of the economic health for the average person of a country. And there are kind of three waves that I want to talk about today with homelessness and economics in American history. Not so much as, you know, an abstract reflection on the nature of economics and what would it be like if we went back to a pure gold standard or had a bimetallic standard, or what would it be like if I didn't have to buy crypto because the dollar's not going to be worth anything soon. You know,
it's too late to get on that ground floor, let me tell you.
Right. Goodness. Yeah. You're getting in on like the 38th floor at this point. But not so much an abstract reflection, but just noticing how homelessness correlates, spikes in homelessness, everyone observed or observes, correlates with economic destruction. And you can call it creative destruction if you want to, but for sort of a very average person with an average level of training and experience, these time periods in American history have been pretty destructive, regardless of what the messaging was around them.
So time periods when homelessness is on the rise.
Yeah.
And then looking at these for patterns in what, power structure?
Yeah, and kind of telling you where things are going. So the three periods really are what get called maybe in your American history textbook in high school, the Gilded Age, the Great Depression. That mm-hmm. one has a clear label, see? And then also the present, whatever you think the present is.
So yeah, the Great Depression is definitely in my sphere of growing up and remembering. Grapes of Wrath was reading. Did most of it.
Interesting. Yeah.
California, San Diego High School. Sure. So yeah. California literature is a big deal in that regard. But, you know, Dust Bowl was part of it. I also was exposed to it when I went to undergrad at Sonoma State University, so a California state school, and a small liberal arts school, very focused on California as well. And so there was a compelled California literature course I had to take. Learned all about Central Valley things, how the Central Valley used to be like half, not half, it's like a fifth of it was a lake at one point, and they completely ruined the ecosystem with the initial farming. So I don't know whether or not that was just propaganda from the state at that point to get me on board the green messaging. I don't know. But what came out of all of that was came away as an American with a very strong feel that it was good that the Great Depression had passed, that whatever was going on at that time in our country, my grandma was better off after World War II. And that, well, that's kind of the narrative a little bit, isn't it?
Totally. And you may even have heard in either high school or college of the term Hooverville.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, which are simply homeless encampments in the 1930s.
And that'd be like calling it Trumpvilles, right? Like you're trying to blame the opposition.
That's right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Soundbite.
Yeah, I mean, that would be what what's really interesting is they're still called Hoovervilles even after Hoover leaves office in 32.
Right, Obamacare.
Right, yeah, there you go. Yeah, so it would be like calling it a Trumpville, you know, 2 years from now or something.
Yeah.
Because you, what you do is, and this is, I think, part of the, maybe the facade of electoral politics as both cause and solution to problems, is that you're taught to call certain things after specific political antagonists, and that's going to be used over and over. So right now it's white nationalism on the left and part of the right, and on most of the right, it is the Chinese Communist Party. Never like the Communist Party of China or something. It's always the Chinese Communist Party. And what you do with a label like that, or a label like Hooverville or Obamacare, is that it remains useful even when the person is gone. So Herbert Hoover, I don't really know if people want a whole show on Herbert Hoover. There's a lot that's misunderstood or just not even understood. But he's kind of a complex person and is actually famous prior to becoming American president for solving people's economic problems and food shortages, especially in Europe after the First World War. So the idea that the guy was just completely incompetent and didn't care about people really is not borne out by everything in his life prior to 1930.
Yeah, all that matters is that you're on the right side of history. And clearly right. He was not. Any schools named after him are due to be replaced with more inclusive names in the future. But jargoning, labeling, categorizing, the modern age Platonic thought is built upon these categories, and we need them. Yet what you're kind of describing is almost an, well, it is. It's an idolatry of them, or a certain lifting up of certain categories as static, permanent things to be relied upon. And then, does that make sense? Yes, I think that's what I want to
say.
Yeah,
I think, well, it's also why you get such a time delay between people realizing certain facts, which in many cases they themselves observe, and then realizing later on why those things were, right? So a process that in on a macro level, a lot of people have experienced in the past year, which is what I'm told is not what I see, exists inside a term like Hooverville, where homelessness rises in the 1930s and unemployment is kind of a chronic problem in the 1930s in the United States, really up until, we start ramping up for war when Europe goes to war. So the economy changes fairly drastically, and manufacturing in a place like California or really throughout the United States really ramps up as we ramp up for war, which we do long before Pearl Harbor.
Right, right, right. And that is definitely a part of where the economy jumpstart comes from.
Right.
Whether or not that has anything to do with your gold, silver standard and all that, you know, how you're managing inflation and what books are just being moved around and where's the money coming from has got to come from somewhere. There's right. a lot of story there.
Right.
What I was trying to get at before, I still want to see if I
sure.
if I get
yeah.
there on this, that when a phrase like a Hooverville comes up
mm-hmm.
and then gets latched onto and exists outside of that person's place in the political ecosystem, what that is a useful accusation, even a demonization. There's a demon, if you can just think secularly here, mm-hmm. there's an idea, a demon that has been named that we can witch hunt. And this is what branding sort of will do. But I think if we look at those phrases we were talking about, they're usually the enemy's tag. Mm-hmm. They are, and sometimes you wear them with pride a little bit. That's what Lutheran actually kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
But then to see that the tendency to do that, it will then harden or woodenize, and that it becomes its own destruction. So this useful term or this useful label that, say, the right will cling to, say, the CCP, will become its own demon that isn't actually out there. And you end up fighting against ideas that are, again, more of your jargonizing. You're attempting to hold to a nostalgic quest, maybe, than what the real front is. And I think that's why you're walking us through these conversations, is to try to show us the real front. I'm talking about how the bigger narrative that we're getting all the time has a wooden infrastructure that's very, very tight. It's hard to see through. But when it starts to collapse, you can see how brittle it is. And this labeling and holding to labels that no longer really work is where that brittleness is. The lies we're sharing with each other, and we're just like, okay, it's a lie. Okay, well, that's a label that doesn't work anymore. That's where the brittleness is. And for my part, these conversations about trying to find those and relabel with solid, platonic or otherwise, real categories, right? Real truths we can actually talk about. I think I got there. So thank you if that made sense and helped you. Good. If not, it was my show, so go away. Not you, Dr. Koons. You can
talk. I think that, like, in a term like Hooverville, what you're dealing with is something that then becomes useful because you hear it and you think, okay, I'm going to vote for FDR because he'll get us out of this because Hoover got us into this. And what that does is that it makes me dependent on something like news to inform me of how my life is going to go and elections to help me determine whether I'm going to do well in life or do poorly in life. And it's that sense of alienation from the daily circumstances of my life that induces not just passivity, but a total lack of responsibility. And something that we're talking about in the chat today is in the Discord is something about the notion of sin and inherited sin and blaming one's ancestors, or conversely, thinking your ancestors were amazing. And I think that what this political cycle of naming and assignment of evils, especially naming of demonology, really does is that it prevents me from actually owning in any real sense what is wrong with my life.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm uniquely and solely responsible for everything that's ever happened in my life, but what this calling something a Hooverville or saying the problem is Obama. I mean, Obamacare does have an enormous number of problems that it's created for all kinds of people, from independent doctors to people who have to buy it or face some enormous tax penalty. It's not that I'm solely responsible. And if I just think the right thoughts and put on a smile every day, everything's going to work out. But it prevents me from going through the process of understanding that would actually give me a lot more freedom in my daily life, which is what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
What can I do about it? Where can I go? What do I care about? And it's that sense of passivity and dependence on outside circumstances that I think is really the thing that eviscerates America long before 2020. Because whatever our myths were, it is sort of an undeniable truth about early American history that if in many ways you don't make life for yourself, you don't have life. Because the bargain of moving here is you get freedom, but you don't get surrounding supports of whatever customs and all kinds of things over generations that have been built up where you came from. If I don't own that, if I don't own myself and what's wrong with me, it's why the genre, I think, of self-help originates in America. And I don't mean that in sort of a cheesy way. The reason you have to master yourself is because you're what you have to figure things out. And calling this Hoover's problem or FDR's problem, it doesn't mean that they have no agency or that they don't have a lot more power in life than I do, but it does mean that I'm focusing way more on them and their power than on what I can do. And it's not an accident that this show has morphed over however many episodes we're on now from just about events and about history. That's not going to change, but also about what you can do, because I hope if you're listening to this, you're realizing that you can both understand a lot of things that you don't control, but you can also do a lot more than you've been told you can.
You can't do anything about the homeless problem in California. That's Joe Biden, and who's their governor now? Did they impeach him or not? I don't know. That's their issue.
Mm-hmm.
You can do something about your street, the corner of your street, your neighborhood, your town. Again, so the stories from far away always stop you from being involved in the actual, in what's near you, and you go searching for an answer from far away. What happens when that temporal solution or that temporal idol, whatever you want to call it, though, Trump, what happens when he's not the news anymore? For so long, that's been the fight you have to fight in your heart for the sake of America, right?
That's right, yeah.
And now it's gone, except I guess he's got a website. I don't know. I opened Twitter for like half a second today. Goodness, and Trump's there. So, but like, where do you go? Our people are searching for that. They need it. They need a new accusation, demonization, enemy. Right. I know 1984 and Brave New World do come up in the Mad Discord quite a bit between people. We're not heading toward those things. Those things are versions of where we are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, totally. And the thing that I think correlations that you can see, like white liberals hate themselves more than any group of any political persuasion or race hates itself. That's the thing that I think about more than I do about what someone's specific position on like the Keystone XL pipeline is, because I see the overwhelming misery of life that a lot of people experience on a daily basis, that children are experiencing as they go to school and are going to be wearing masks until 2042 or whatever. That to me is much more concerning, because like media, it controls the soul. And I can change my diet more easily than I can change information intake, because I'm accustomed to it. So I care a lot more that people hate themselves or feel miserable all the time. That's going to have certain political outcomes. It's not at all an accident that when you get like Antifa arrest photos, they're all pretty much reliably, regardless of race, visually hideous people. They hate themselves. They live in a way which is unaesthetic and self-destructive. And I know that they know it because they're human beings. So they're sensitive on some level to these things, even if they've been taught to love ugliness and to love destruction, even self-destruction. But that finally is the concern for me, not that there is more or less. I mean, we talked last time about the poor you will always have with you. It's not like homelessness will go away. But if I'm told that, well, this will go away if you elect this person, or this will go away if you take this socially righteous moral position that you share with every Fortune 500 company, then obviously that's going to be a lie, because it was a lie in the case of Hooverville. So homelessness here, it's such a great barometer, because it's an issue no one has to care about politically. So it's a particularly large playground for the play of something that they do in every other realm of life, which is to tell you things that you empirically can experience are not the case, such as all homelessness going on in 1934 America is because Herbert Hoover just didn't care the way Franklin Delano Roosevelt does.
That's right. Well, that's why things are going to be better now with COVID, is because Uncle Joe understands. So before we, I want to go more directly at California, but first, okay. Gilded Age.
Yeah.
I'm completely oblivious to the Gilded Age.
Okay. Gilded Age is a phrase that Mark Twain uses for kind of post-Civil War, pre-Spanish-American War America, so between 65 and 98. And
what we're supposed to think is Reconstruction, though. We're supposed to think that's Reconstruction.
It's Reconstruction in the South.
But the whole thing is then the Gilded Age.
The whole thing is the Gilded
Age. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Reconstruction only the, and Reconstruction is a process I think we've talked about before,
right,
of simultaneous social, mental, and political change on a scale that we're really only seeing now.
Right.
The Gilded Age generally is something that if you look into like the Ulysses Grant administration, the Andrew Johnson administration, any of these generally Republican administrations after the Civil War, because they had such power, you'll find that there are all kinds of shady deals and insider trading and stuff. Some of that is overblown. Some of it is not unique to the Gilded Age. But what you do find is that you get income disparity in the Gilded Age on a level not really seen until today. And today, even, you know, California is more similar to Gilded Age America than a lot of other states.
So go straight at that then. How? In what way? Talk about it directly.
So what you have are, especially after the Civil War, but even during the Civil War in the North, immense profits being made off the war, especially through railroads, which are really the sort of breakthrough technology similar to the internet in the late 20th century and early 21st.
So the profits from the war post-Civil War are similar to Silicon Valley's juju. Whatever they did with whatever aliens they talked to get those screens to be magical, like that is, that was a gold mine, golden goose.
Yeah, and a difference being actually that railroads in the 19th century more reliably pay out dividends to investors, whereas stock buybacks and just enormous piles of cash are far more common. So the wealth is actually spread more fairly in the 19th century, even so, than it is today. It's harder to get in on today's wealth than it was then. But what happens in 1873 is specifically that people begin to notice what are going to be called soon after that hobos or tramps kind of all over America. And not only in much larger numbers in the cities, not yet so much in California, mostly in San Francisco, though Los Angeles isn't really a whole lot of anything at the time. But also even in rural America, which is sort of a first, that there are vagrant men kind of wandering around the landscape. And this is more or less a first for people, but you have kind of two sources of this. One is enormous unemployment in the Depression of 1873, which you won't see the like of until the 1930s. Another source is the vagrancy induced by war. That is, you can sometimes find Westerns telling this story, which most people have forgotten in straight history, that after the Civil War, there are lots of men in the North and the South who find that they really can't go back to life.
Right.
And that's not really all that unusual after a war, certainly not after a war that involves such an enormous percentage of able-bodied males in the United States. So vagrancy is just up. And I mentioned something like this when we talked about Reconstruction with freed slaves, but it exists also among whites. And in Indian territory, also among Indians who are, we said earlier, largely Confederate. Vagrancy affects anybody who finds that life as he knew it before the war is either unsatisfactory or unbearable for any number of reasons. So you have the development of something that will later be romanticized, I think, largely. I mean, you can find it in kind of old Warner Brothers cartoons, tramps as characters. But what it is, and the way that it really begins in large, noticeable numbers in the Gilded Age, is because of this combination of I can't get a job, period. Not just a good job. I can't get a job. I don't know where to go. And I don't know if I can exist with normal people anymore. And you begin to get what are really a sort of dropouts. So people mentioned on the Discord channel, some people are homeless by choice. That's totally true. Some are not, but even in the 19th century, that's totally true. And the by choice may or may not be positive choice, but it is choice. And
I mean,
you know,
if you
if
want to get in a
yeah.
discussion about like free will salvation and like fatalism versus like who's got guilt or shame, whether or not it's your fault, it just seems like splitting hairs to me. An individual doesn't end up on the street because as a baby they were like, "Hey, you know what? I'm gonna grow up and be a homeless punk." Something wasn't helpful along the way, probably, right? But that does not exculpate them from the who they are. They are who they are. You own who you are. Forget like whether it's your fault or not, and I'm being shamed and blah blah. You are what you are now, so face it today, and we've all got to do that. So in that way, that it's your choice. I like the language of just having discipline instead. Wherever you are today, discipline yourself. And I don't know if that's a choice so much as something that often a father tells you to do and you listen. And maybe there's a lack of that. So I'm telling you right now, today, discipline yourself. Yeah, that shifted from where you're going. Dropout trauma is what I wrote down. So that you have these over-traumatized humans. They don't have a way to engage reality anymore, but they're still alive. They can't be in the cities as constituted. They aren't going to farm, and so they wander. California, where did they come from? Who is this? I mean, I mean, there is vets. I'm sure there are vets involved. Is that how much of this is immigration? I'm curious about some of those more modern factoids, just to kind of paint the picture.
I think in saying choice, something to recognize about late 19th century America is that something that had always existed in American history was beginning not to exist, which is the notion of a frontier. And this is, I think, something to think about very seriously for anybody, because I find that conservatives tend to romanticize village life or agrarian life, strictly speaking. That is, you're locked into a work cycle over generations on a farm. And I think it is important to recognize that things like railroads and industrialization make possible the idea that there is nowhere to go that is just away. And there is a certain percentage of people, I think, in any human population that if they can, want to get away. I don't think just being alone, but being free. I think it's what attracts a lot of people right now to the notion of a side hustle. They're not so much looking for, you know, a 3X their income. What they're looking for is freedom because they hate what they have. And however great you think, you know, working on a farm might have been prior to the advent of industrial machinery available to you and enormous debt, it's a lot of work and not everybody wants to do it that way and live that way. So I think that when you're thinking about something like hobos or tramps as a sort of culture with its own signage for which railroad cars it's safe to get into, for instance, all things that actually happen over time, I would look at it in somewhat a similar way that you look at why did your ancestors come here, or why did they move from Virginia to Nebraska, or whatever your family's story is, or why do you not want to work in the office that you work in? Because there's something that whatever happened to you or was done to you, I don't think it's solely explicable in terms of like psychological wounding or even physical wounding. I think it also has to do when you experience liminal things like war. That actually can be in some ways an awakening of things within you that could be extremely positive, but you were unaware of before. And there's no way that where you came from can actually contain that any longer.
Well, say in a culture like ours, masculinity, and anybody right. who goes into the military and then comes out again, a man having found certain level of aggression is acceptable, and yeah. now it's not. Right. And there's a whole level of that. So again, I'm going to push them the same question. So how many vets are in these homeless camps in California right now?
Right now?
Yeah. Like who is this group? I mean, you talked about this big city over there. You know, who is this? What's the history of how this group gets there and then locates in that space?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, California is unique, not only in numbers, just outpacing everybody else, but it's also unique in that because of the enormous income disparity in California, the preponderance of vets that is sort of a trope, even in like movies from the 80s and 90s about the homeless, and is also a trope in signage that if you see a homeless or purportedly homeless person at a traffic intersection, he probably will claim to be a vet, and he may well be statistically. But California is a little unusual in that its income disparity creates homelessness because it makes housing, even for people that would be comfortably middle class in Ohio,
right.
It makes life just that much more difficult.
Right. Impossible. Really,
yeah. Right.
To maintain
right.
the rent. And it's just right. rent. You're not even owning it.
Right. Right. And so if you're trying to follow the rules and you're not willing or you're not able to just build, you know, unzoned, unsupervised, outside building codes, housing, right? Just straight up favelas like they have in Brazil. If you're not willing to do that, then your options are pretty limited. And zoning requirements, like we said last time, if this area is zoned for, it has to be this way and it has to be earthquake proof or whatever the requirements are, if I can't do anything without all that, then my best option, certainly my cheapest option, is just not to have a permanent home.
Right. What I see happening here in Northwestern Illinois is that there are generations. I don't know how much of it's renting and how much of it's owning, but nobody fixes anything. Like, I'm sure there are things on the inside. You can go into some of these houses, the outside's deteriorated, the inside, but things are just let go. And you go past these houses that are, they got tarps over their roof and stuff. And at a certain point, it's because they just can't afford it. Well, duh, they can't afford it. But part of that is you got to go through the gilded groups that in order to get what you want done. It all has to be according to certain codes and regulations. Things are limited where you can build, like you said. And so, you know, that's interesting to then push that idea, run it back into California, where if that wasn't California, this homeless tent city would already be a shack city. You'd already have buildings there.
Yeah.
People would just be doing it. But somehow now they can't. I don't know why they don't do it. We got enough of them now. Just
yeah,
do it.
I mean, in some cases, like there was a recent attempted clearance in Echo Park, which is, you know, which is a neighborhood of Los Angeles. It didn't quite work, because something that is sort of nascent in all of this is that places that have enormous numbers of homeless, not just California, also tend to have very left-wing politics. And so you get a certain percentage of the politically active element in that area that is completely supportive of keeping homeless encampments up. And right. Because homeless encampment, the taking down of homeless encampments, the enforcement of vagrancy ordinances and things like that, because that is identified with trying to make public life orderly, which you'll notice orderly public life really only matters to you under a certain income level. So middle-class people tend to care a lot about whether or not there are broken windows in the downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Upper-class people can afford to just go places at speeds that they don't have to care how right. most people live.
Right.
And lower-class people know they don't have a say. So in very left-wing places, you will get non-enforcement or even active hostility to what was called, when Rudy Giuliani did this in New York City in the early 2000s, a broken windows policing policy, which is, if I clean up homeless encampments or I prosecute you if you do something like breaking a window or, kind of famously in Singapore, spitting on the sidewalk.
Right, right.
That's actually going to have all kinds of other social and legal effects on our society that are going to be positive, because not permitting low-level criminality or liminality will actually make life more pleasant for everybody.
Modeling proper etiquette makes life more pleasant.
Yeah, and I think something that you notice constantly in modern American life, this is why I see homelessness as a barometer of so much else, is if you see homelessness as sort of an intrusion on public space, right? Let's help you get somewhere else so you don't have to intrude on everyone else's space all of the time to live, is very similar, honestly, to the utter destruction of politeness in modern American life. I mean, people just are impolite to each other. They're rude. So like when someone gets on the news, there was a lady that in Alabama that ran over this old woman while just racing her car on the street and got in the news. She was let out on bail and, you know, basically said, like, I didn't do anything. This lady did something, you know, just
right.
No remorse, not even a second thought about whether she could be culpable. The reason that happens and is because there are so much, maybe everything in life telling you you're looking out for number one and everyone else is a problem unless they're helping you get where you want to go. And so this loss of politeness destroys the notion of public life in the same way that someone camping out on the sidewalk makes that sidewalk impassable for
loss
you.
Of politeness is pretty historically associated with cities and city states, though, isn't it? I mean, all the way way back, as far as history goes. If you see the homeless as the problem, rather than as people having problems, maybe that's the issue. And that's why I buckle at the word choice a little bit. Like, absolutely, discipline and ownership of where you are.
Mm-hmm.
But the homeless as people are not the problem, right? They have to be seen first as people, not this objective thing we can solve.
Yeah, we're not going to solve it, and just no one will ever be homeless again in a country of 300 some million, whatever it actually is.
Or the loss of love in seeing them as the problem. Oh, they have a choice. Well, or some people have a choice as a way of dismissing the entire scenario is it shows what you're talking about. Our civilization has become heartless. And I would contend it's probably because we're so distant from everything. Everything is viewed through a screen. It's far away. I've learned to stabilize my traumas with regard to those images. They no longer traumatize me the way they would if I had never seen them before. We're like, oh my gosh, it's real, right? So instead, I've learned to just kind of absorb it all. So I've got to be distant, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're heartless. We're heartless to this stuff because it's stories from far away. Where again, I think if you run into an actual, well, I live where I see homeless people when I drive, and mm-hmm. it's hard to ignore them. Rockford has drawn enough. Mm-hmm. God bless my wife. She set up some bags that we could hand out this winter. So I didn't have to feel like a complete wealthy white jerk driving past these, you know, people in the winter, vets asking for food, all this kind of stuff. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I see it there. And to me, that the reason this conversation matters to me is not because California, I don't know, it's here. And that's a human. It's each one of those is a human. Mm-hmm. And until we as people can see that, we're not going to solve the problem. I mean, gas them, I guess. We could just go gas them all. I bet you that's where they go, man. Give it 50 years. Give it 50 years.
I think that structural, ongoing, and even deepening problems like that are actually fairly valuable to the system. So I don't see it as advantageous for them to eliminate those problems. A place that is more advanced in some of these dynamics than we are, which is Brazil, which I mentioned before with favelas, the left, which thought that it was going to be a kind of permanent ruling party until Bolsonaro was elected. The left uses poverty not really to like bring people out of it in any sense, but as a reliable voting block.
Right.
And so I think that it's much easier and simpler and more advantageous to make, you know, same day automatic voting registration legal and then federally supervised everywhere, rather than to say, okay, we're going to have a structural solution to homelessness. It's going to be administered by the states. We're going to recognize California as a special case.
I mean, at a certain point, they you have to segment off that part of the world and, you know, box it in, Escape from New York style. It isn't part of civilization somewhere, somehow. And I guess the question is the leeching effect that has on an area, and how much the elites in that area really want that area. Just getting rid of 100,000 people in prime real estate ain't so easy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you got to move them somewhere. I don't know. Yeah. I just, you're right. It's there, and the state is always going to make use of it. I see, you know, what do you call it? Immigration, helping them move to relocation to camps for happy homeless people. I can see that, right? And we'd all be taxed for it and everything. It'd be great. You know, we can give more money to everybody. And so I don't know. I just don't think it's so fanciful. I think that Brazil, as an advanced version of California, as an advanced version of the United States, is an interesting perspective on like trajectory.
Yeah, well, because Brazil is very good at creating and then negotiating various kinds of dependency. It's got an enormous population, certainly for South America, and it's got an enormously diverse population. Brazil has enormous German and Japanese communities.
Right.
Nobody remembers that, in addition to everyone that you know, Amazonian Indians and all the rest. So what they're good at is managing dependencies and then keeping near constant strife over a shifting dynamic of programs for the poor, that's the left, and then crackdowns on crime, that's the right, moving back and forth. But one thing you can see with Bolsonaro, people say, oh, well, he's Brazil's Trump. That's true and not true. There's a sense in which he's beyond Trump, because he is beyond Trump in the sense that he is both represents an existential threat to some infrastructures of power that exist. That's very much like Trump. But the beyondness consists in really exhibiting no desire to return. And this is something that I find fascinating about the future of America, is that when the appeal of the past is just completely gone, right? You don't have a significant number of people who can even remember the 70s, let alone the 50s. You're going to move into a different thing where, especially on the right, I think people will begin to speak about a future, and it may use elements of the past. It may be a sort of return to the past in some measure, right? The founders were doing that with Roman republicanism, but it will be itself unprecedented because no one alive will have experienced it. And I think when you're thinking about a place like California, you have to think about Bolsonaro, or even in what appears to be a sort of a burgeoning way, Ron DeSantis in Florida, because you're dealing, Florida, like California, has a large homeless population, not nearly so big, but still quite large. But Florida is a place that was sort of famously a bellwether for the South in slipping from reliably conservative to swing, right? and was the focus of a much different America's, you know, hanging Chad problem 21 years ago. But Florida, because of some moves that were made in the 1980s politically and structurally, but also because changing demographics in Florida didn't mean quite what the left thought they would mean, Florida has become a different kind of a place. It's not solidly white and black, and therefore very Southern in its political dynamics, like it was 50 years ago. But with very different demographics, it's also not at all reliably liberal. And in fact, especially since COVID, has been reliably kind of contrarian to our liberal establishment in a way that Texas used to be very reliably and isn't quite right now.
It almost was, kind of could be, pretends they ought to be. Remember the Alamo. I'm not going to say Texas is out for the count, but once nostalgia dies, how does the superpower regime manage dependencies? And the dollar coming into that too, I had a really strange phenomena. I had two amounts of money given to me by the American government over this year in the name of stimulus, whatever. And then I had to do taxes, and I had to give every single dollar back to them. Not because that was how it's supposed to work, just how my life worked out. And then suddenly, I mean, I didn't even know this was coming. My wife told me she heard about it. There's a third one. Look at that. And they gave it all back. So now this money's changed hands three times. It's just a story in my bank account about these dollars on which I am dependent. And I'm beginning to trust them less. As you can see, they flow awful fast these days. We're just printing it. And, you know, I mentioned cryptocurrency earlier. Managing dependencies, though, is the idea here, to see that even your financial capacity to buy food is a dependency on a certain someone's story. And what this show was really genesis out of is, I think, mutual recognition of the overarching story of America being one we should not just trust anymore and think through deeply. Hence, looking at homelessness as a barometer for where we are and where we should go. So with, you know, we got 10 minutes at least here. I mean, what have we not covered yet in my wanderings that you need to make sure, you know, today we aimed at something. Did we hit it? What else do we need to make sure we don't miss?
I think something else to recognize is that homelessness is a barometer because it always spikes when life just isn't actually going that well for average Americans who don't have investment capital or real estate investments, who are, you know, labor under the most punitive tax brackets, which is you get a W-2. You don't own a business, you don't have real estate, you don't have capital investments of any kind. Americans who just get a W-2, even before that exists, are always going to suffer the most because they're the most economically vulnerable and subject to change of anybody, in addition to small businesses closing. And so if you see something like homelessness increasing, what you're also seeing is that despite the fact that the Fed says, okay, we've been pumping money in, we're not going to quite report to you anymore how much money we're pumping in because quantitative easing is just the way the world works now. Even if that's the case, and they say, well, you know, inflation is low, even though you can see that it's groceries and gas are very different. What you can look at is the fact that homelessness is this sort of chronic and indeed in many places growing problem visible in public life in a way that it was not in 1992. So you don't have to wait for someone to interpret life to you, certainly not me. You can yourself see what is happening. What I'm saying is you can actually trust your experience more than the interpretations that you're told. Because even if, and the system is, our especially our media is very good at this, they'll find these sort of outliers and then they'll give you an interpretation for that. So if you notice, for instance, that homelessness has spiked, well, that's because of government cuts to mental health funding and similar programs since the 1970s. That's the real explanation. So if you just increase that line item in federal, state, and local budgets, problem solved. You see how this works. You don't have to think about those people as people who have certain experiences and think to yourself, what kind of experiences is America inflicting on its most vulnerable members that we have so many more people living this way than used to? You don't have to think about that. You can just think, let's get the Republicans out of office so that this problem gets solved.
So interestingly, I think what you're advocating empiricism a little bit. You're advocating looking at your experience and trusting it to be true as a path toward knowledge. That is what the modern Enlightenment goal was. It's really come full circle, it would seem, for a lot of people or the system itself. But I, not wanting to embrace modernism myself, I'm not opposed to empiricism as you're describing it. And so this is this natural argument we've made, you've made several times now, and it's come back to me. I'm sharing with other people as well that what I observe if I just sit and watch for like a week is normal. Like it is. And like I can take that further and learn even more. I can begin to be one who inhabits my habitat with understanding. And that is much more difficult to do when I'm letting a bunch of voices that don't share my habitat talk to me, or entertain me, put me to sleep, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that what we're saying is that the model for gaining knowledge is to have information and indeed to have information overload rather than what would be called in a previous time, maybe wisdom, which involves reflection. And so, for instance, like, the number of Americans that have a college degree and indeed even like a master's degree and even a doctoral degree of some kind is vastly larger, both absolutely and relatively, than it was in 1950. Does that mean that we're actually smarter or wiser or better human beings than we were on average in 1950? I think that's debatable at the very least, because there's a difference here between wisdom, which requires reflection on experience and self-evaluation, and information, which requires neither of those things. I can be enormously informed on the history of, federal drug policy without knowing whether or not I should let my 15-year-old smoke pot. So the question here is really about a personal change. And this is, I've had a variety of writing projects for a while. I mean, the book that I'm actually like writing like actively, I sit down and write this, and enjoy it, is a book about personal wisdom in different spheres of life, because it's not so much the book in which I'm most interested. I think if left to my own devices, I would write like a 6-volume history of colonial Virginia or something stupid like that,
I got you.
But it's a book that I think people actually might want and might be useful to them. Because the thing that I consistently find in my own experience is that I and other people don't so much lack information, we lack the capacity to have the information that we do have, especially from our own lives, be useful to us.
Yeah. My lead piece from Ed Mundy this week was I've come to value contemplation more than information, because I got plenty of information and not enough contemplation going on. If a listener right now is homeless, what should that person do?
I would seek out any number of available ways to help you. But first of all, I would go to a church because they need to and are commanded by their master to help you in a holistic way, in a way that will deal both with things outside you that need to change and can change with help, with growth, but also things inside you because of what has happened to you or what's gone on in your life that also need to be healed, mended, corrected, whatever it might be. So if you want to help or if you need this help, I think that the church is probably the place to start. It's not the only place you'll need to go. It's not the only place that can help, but it will certainly deal with what is wrong most directly and holistically if they are at all following, the plan outlined by the one who's in
Oh,
charge
and
of them.
that's where they may have to look for a church after they found a church, and then they may have to do it again
Yeah, that's possible.
and again. And this is one of the challenges of our age. One of the things I was thinking about is how if you are in that situation, you might end around on the whole thing with some of the conversation and realize how free you are. You actually, at this point, have nothing to lose. Not a single thing. You have a chance to see precisely what you are, precisely what you're capable of, dust. And you're going to go back to it. And so own that. That's okay. Okay? Well, it's what we are. You know, the Bible calls it sinful. Jesus saves it from it. All that. But, like, owning it allows you to then walk on it. And, you know, so where you are, see that you don't owe anybody anything except yourself right now. See how free you are. And then stand on it. And with that freedom, try to find one other person. Try to find one other person today that you can now help them. Now, you've realized you're free enough. You have hands that you can do one good thing for someone else. You go do that today. Figure out what that is. Start praying to Jesus, maybe. Or this, you know, this is our secular show. Start praying to Jesus. Find a church where they actually teach what the Bible says. But remember, like right where you are is enough. And that's kind of what we're driving at all the way with this thing. Huh?
We're going to go on from here. And what I'm going to be doing is not overwhelming people quite so much as I naturally do. So in each show,
I think that's why they listen, man. I'm sure you should pull back.
That's part of it. So what I want to do is devote a little more time each show to some of the, let's say, helpful stuff that we often get into, but to do it more consciously in connection with something that's going on. So for instance, next week, I want to look into the growing calls for more domestic surveillance. I think it actually has a deeper history in a lot of America than Americans think. Obviously, it's grown over the past 20 years since September 11th. But what you can do in view of those things and in future, rather than being reactive to what's going on or to what could potentially happen, and talking on the internet about how scared you are, rather than being scared, what can you do?
Mm-hmm. Tell the boogeyman you're afraid of him. That doesn't seem like the way to go. You know, I went right past what we wanted to open the show with today. Do you still got time for this quote from Discord?
Yeah, sure.
That we got this contact. Actually, they sent this in to, I believe, redfish.com/contact, and it got to both of us. Regarding your most recent brief history of power on poverty and homelessness is the last one. Consider this thesis. If you wish to become wealthy, find a way to sell goods or services to the poor. Consider the check cashing stores that charge excessive fees found in poor neighborhoods. They also somehow skirt usury laws and obscene interest on payday loans. Finally, they make money on the fees and exchange rate as people wire money back to their native country. Credit challenged and need a car loan? Enter something with rates 28%. Mm-hmm. The borrower has paid the value of the car multiple times. Terms are so long, they are typically paying long after the car has died. Yeah, so just to throw into that mix, you know, your home loan ain't so far off that mark.
No, it's not. And again, like to see like, okay, well, this neighborhood has a ton of check cashing stores and a convenience store with bars on all the windows and, you know, pre-COVID plexiglass everywhere. Why is that? Well, that's not so unlike you. That's a barometer of something. Because if you go back to the 1920s, there is no such thing as a 30-year home mortgage. Nobody's going to do that to you. You can either pay for a house in 10 years or, you know, you can rent and there's no shame in that. Renting was a much higher percentage of the population once upon a time, but there is no 30-year home mortgage because nobody's going to gouge you like that. Yeah. You can't get credit cards the way you can now because they know that most of you are not going to pay it off at the end of the month. That's why those things exist. They're really great if you're disciplined, but they know most of you are not. And so they take advantage of that. So here, again, not necessarily just homelessness, but also how the poor who are more or less banked or informally banked are really just a barometer of something that's happening to basically everybody.
Let me ask one more. So
yeah,
how do you avoid becoming homeless? And I'm talking now to someone who is, they're completely secure right now.
Yeah.
But they're a modern adult male and they realize how fragile it all is.
Mm-hmm.
And this has haunted them long before COVID. They just are realizing it now.
Right.
The terror they carry that their kids are going to be on the street, that somehow it won't work out. That's why the coffee, that's why the late nights, all that. Right. To talk to that a little bit.
I think that when you think about the future, there are an enormous number of things over which you don't have control. So, you know, if you're on a watch list, if you don't have control over that, maybe you're going to be on a no-fly list because you didn't take the vaccine, whatever. You don't really have control over that to a large degree. The things over which you have control do, however, amount to a lot. And one thing to think about, and this is one of the things that I'm going to be stressing really from here on out in an effort to be less historically dense a little bit and a little bit more proactively positive, because I don't think I'm nearly as depressed by what I say as some of the listeners are. I don't want them to be sad. So, is think about groups that are not trying to stay where you are. And that could be physically. So they're not trying to stay in your neighborhood because your neighborhood is absurdly expensive and your children could never afford to live there. Or they're not trying to be accepted in a mainstream way, the way you have, or at least the way you were taught to, right? So how do I opt out? It seems to me that the best way to opt out is to do it in a group. So a lot of people, for instance, think, okay, well, one way that I'm going to get more freedom is I'm going to start kind of a side business, and hopefully it'll develop into something where first I don't have to go into the office, and then I don't even have an office because I'm my own boss. Blah, blah. Think about doing that maybe with four or five other people in a legally constructive and defined way. There are ways to do this. You know, there are entire towns in Florida where you can't live there if you're under the age of 50. That's legal because the corporation owns all that land. They can make whatever rules they want on their roads that you can only have golf carts on. You have a lot more freedom legally and financially than you realize. It's just that you're not taught this stuff in civics class. And I would advise you, if you're worried, to think not just about, okay, how can I keep my job or how can I keep my home? Those are good things to think about, but also, how can I find a community? Or if I'm already in some kind of community, how can that community actually be positively reinforcing for my home, for my family's well-being, for my health, okay, collectively? Because the idea that you're going to succeed on your own in life just isn't even true. And it never was, and that's fine, right? But the Amish guy who's got 10 beautiful children and has a future for them is doing that with about 15 other Amish guys and their 10 children on average. He's not living life alone, not financially, not legally, not occupationally. So I think if you want to make it,
he might get sick and die.
He might. Sure. That's, you know, that's life. That's the way it goes. There's an element of risk, I think, to living with which almost all of us have been almost entirely unfamiliar up to recently. We just never imagined it could go this way.
Risk is part of the zest of life.
Risk is part of life. I mean, I have been, the thing that has shocked me is how many people who are 80 years old and have cancer telling me they never thought this would happen.
I get you.
Exactly.
Story well.
I don't think,
you didn't see it coming, huh?
All really?
50 years of cigarettes. You didn't see it, huh? Wow. Go figure.
I mean, So I would say part of the best way to mitigate risk, not just for you, but especially for your legacy, is to do it in a group. Otherwise, it's you against the world. And that story is a popular story. You've been told many times over. It's just not one that occurs all that often in history. Even if you're Alexander or Napoleon, and there has to be an army to do some fighting for you. So nobody does any of this stuff alone, even when they're leaders, let's say.
Right. Well, I think that ends up being, for me, where my question is, and we're over time, but that's all right. It's just not easy to find the group to follow or to have the followers find you. It just doesn't move that quick. And that's okay. I think that's part of the message, yeah, too, is that history and life wasn't meant to be, I do this, and then I'm done, and I go here, and I do this. It's like supposed to be like three things, maybe two, like childhood and adulthood. Like that's kind of what it should be mostly, right?
Yeah. And I also think that even the language of social media does not encourage the thing that, especially for men, so politically is most important, which is not so much whom am I following or who is following me, but who is my brother? Because brothers are helpful in a way that followers can't be, because followers are always waiting for me to tell them what to do and what to think. And that is part of life and that is part of group dynamics. But I think in addition to leadership, which is idolized in modern America, mm-hmm, at least aspirationally, brotherhood, which is not part of anybody's aspirational lifestyle, is actually completely necessary. It's necessary for war bands. It's necessary for small enterprise. It's necessary for a lot of life. The capacity to work together and to kind of put off my preferences and what I just want to say, and, you know, all of these things that are sort of fetishized for brotherhood, things like politeness and forbearance and boring stuff like that is absolutely essential the way it is in a marriage. But in order to accomplish things on a level above the immediate family, brotherhood and forbearance are a lot more necessary, I think, than a lot of us have thought of before.
Yes, I would say brotherhood is definitely something that is more necessary than modern society philosophy mm-hmm. possibly could have imagined it being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let me suggest that the reason is because boys need to fight other boys. They need to. It's part of how they grow up. It's good. And a brother is there so that you fight and make up eventually. And then you learn how to engage other guys. And so if there's a mm-hmm. problem with men engaging men in America, it might be because, well, better than half of us are brotherless when it comes down to it. I'm going to just close with this, though, today, if you don't mind. Ecclesiastes 7:2 says this: better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and all the living will take it to heart. Brief History Power, Two White Guys, you know where to find us, or you would not be here.